Hello and welcome back to Failure Peace Theater. I'm your amiable co-host Tim, and joining me this week is
Catherine.
And we're back this time to discuss a little indie gem that's making the rounds. People are talking about this thing, and I think it's pretty well deserved. So we are going to discuss Cobweb, a indie little horror darling, Halloween themed, because we're getting very close to spooky season, right? The season of Samhain is beginning, so we might as well get into that just a little bit. Directed by Samuel Bodin, who is not a name that I was familiar with before this. I don't think he's done a ton of feature film work at this point, but I'm definitely going to be paying attention in the future. So what are your thoughts on Cobweb as we get started?
Well, I didn't know anything about this movie. I watched the Red Letter Media Half in the Bag about it.
Yeah.
And it sounded neat.
It did.
This was a victim of a bad release date. One of the worst. This came out around the same time as Barbenheimer.
As Barbie and Oppenheimer, yes. It was a counter programming exercise, perhaps. Hard to say.
Yeah, released at a weird time. You know, you should put horror movies later in the year if you can get them as close to Halloween, especially with this one being centered around Halloween time. Feels
yes.
really weird to release it in July.
Didn't make a ton of sense for Lionsgate to throw this one out on July 21st, 2023. Here's your Halloween horror, little indie horror experience that you can have in the hottest summer in human history.
Weird. Just weird. And kind of killed
choice.
The movie. Like, this is, this would have done a lot better with, like, a September release. Because people are getting more in the mood for autumnal stuff. But yeah, it sounded fun. I don't know. Of course, you know, we're obviously big fans of Red Letter Media. Who isn't? Like,
yeah, I mean, at
can
this
you
point,
talk about movies
like,
online without being fans?
They're kind of the old men of talking about movies online. You can't really escape that that grip anymore. At least for you know, I think our generation of film fan, you know, we're just sort of definitely embedded in that. You know, old, you know, white middle Americans making fun of movies kind of thing, which, you know, Red Letter Media. I mean, we grew up watching Mystery Science Theater. We noted before and Red Letter Media, while Mystery Science Theater wasn't around, you know, they've always been around Riff Tracks, et cetera, but they've sort of occupied a little bit of that space for me. And so, yeah, I saw the same video, didn't watch the whole thing. Normally, if they release a movie, a video about a movie that I haven't seen yet, I'll kind of like watch enough of it to get a little bit of a taste, and then I'll stop and then go see if I can find it and watch it, which is kind of what I did here. So I didn't want to sort of, this is a movie that has spoilers in it, I suppose, but I think everything's kind of telegraphed super well. I don't think this is a movie where your enjoyment of it is hinged upon a reveal, even though there are certainly reveals in it. It's just a very well-made, small, focused horror film. And I think it works exceptionally well. Like, just to jump into the overview right off the jump. It's an exceptionally well done one of these little horror projects. I guess if we're going to synopsize it, it's about a young boy seemingly sort of beset upon, by his parents. They don't treat him especially well. His home environment is very awkward and strange.
It feels like there's abuse, but you don't really understand the situation. Like, it's really difficult to figure out the motivation of the parents and why they behave the way that they do.
Right.
But it does come together at a certain point why they are so weird, kind of.
Exactly. That is, if anything, the kind of major reveal of the film is why are his parents behaving the
like
way
this?
They do. Yeah, I mean, I think the movie does a good job, and this is one of the things that I think about it that works very subtly in its favor, is that it does a very good job for most of its runtime, not the entirety, but most, of staying sort of deadlocked in the kid's perspective, right? The film's perspective is pretty much embedded in the kid's viewpoint on the world, right? We're not getting a lot of outside input on what's going on. It's all sort of wrapped up in his knowledge base, his awareness, and sort of what he knows and doesn't know. And that's tricky to pull off. I mean, that's something that, you know, I mean, I know everything comes back to Spielberg, but that's one of the things that Spielberg established about his directorial viewpoint that he could pull off very early on, is that he was very good at putting you inside the mind and world of a child, right? Of seeing the world from their perspective. And, you know, this director, you know, Samuel Boden, if he is capable of that, I think he has a pretty successful career ahead of him, because most films, and I mean, we lament the state of movies quite often on here, but I think that's part of the issue, is that a lot of modern movies, they don't have a perspective, right? They don't have a viewpoint. It's just the standard third person David Fincher floating omniscient camera without any of the intentionality behind that omniscient floating camera, right?
Right.
Like, David Fincher's intentionality with a third person floating camera that shows all without restriction is that, oh, it's you're the person providing the perspective. You're the pervert.
Possibly.
Like, that's David Fincher's like point of view, is like, oh, I'm giving you all this information. And then you, the perverted viewer that wants to see all of it, you get to decide what it means.
Yeah.
You know, whereas a lot of modern filmmaking, the more, you know, sort of like workmanlike approach is like, well, I'm going to put the camera here, people will do things, and then we'll just move to the next scene, which is what makes most television boring, right? That's why it's boring to watch. It's because it doesn't have purpose in its work. But this one does. And I think Boden does a pretty solid job of that. So the kid is embedded in this sort of strange environment, strange circumstance with these strange parents. There is a substitute teacher at his school that sort of he bonds with and tries to reach out. But ultimately, it becomes about a voice in the walls. And this is where the horror element, of course, comes in. And the question is what is the voice in the walls? What is its purpose? And how is it trying to either help or hurt this young child? And so just a clever idea. The screenplay is by Chris Thomas Devlin, who this apparently was a spec script that wound up on the blacklist. And we've talked about blacklist movies before. It's a huge boost if your spec script winds up on that. And so this got picked up. The production credits on this are kind of interesting, too. The lead producer is actually Point Grey Pictures, which I don't know if you're familiar with them or look them up. But that is Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
Oh, huh.
Yes, the producers of Neighbors and Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, and Sausage Party produced Cobweb. I think the blacklist, Rogen, say what you want, Rogen does have a good eye for scripts, for the most part. And he does enjoy horror projects. You know, he did produce the unfortunately short-lived Preacher series on AMC, which was pretty solid. So I think he's got a good eye for it. He's also involved in the Invincible show on Amazon with Skybound Entertainment. So, like, you know, Rogen and Goldberg have a good eye for pop culture projects. And I imagine they got this thing for a song. Like, I imagine they got that script for nothing. Yeah. And, you know, you get a little heat behind it, you know, you can do a lot with it. I don't think they have advertised budget. I can't imagine this was more than $3 or $4 million, if that. Like, that's like super high end, we were wasting money on problems kind of thing. And even with being released when it did, it made about 5.7 at the box office. So not amazing, but I still feel like they probably came out of this with a little bit of the budget back, because there was zero marketing.
No
marketing.
The thing that made me click on the video, because I don't watch every single half in the bag, but the reason I clicked on that one was I had never heard of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why does a movie come out in theaters and I don't at least hear about it once?
Yeah, I mean, it ended up being a limited theatrical release, so they didn't even put it on that many screens. I don't know. I don't know what the onus was. Maybe there was a contractual reason for Lionsgate to release this in the window that they did, but it was obvious, but it feels like a contractual release. So maybe it was supposed to go straight to streaming. Maybe that was always the plan. And then somebody said, hey, we got to put this out in theaters. So at least maybe it can win or be nominated for something, you know, because there's some decent special effects work here. The score is pretty solid. Like, there's some stuff happening in this movie that could get attention in the right circumstances. And a lot of that does require some kind of theatrical release to be in contention. So maybe that was all they did with it. Maybe it was always going to be a VOD project. And, you know, Lionsgate's trying to figure out how to be Jason Blum or something. I don't know. I feel like they want to be. I feel like they'd be happy to be. But yeah, so Point Grey Pictures production, Vertigo Entertainment was also involved, which is pretty small, but they have been involved with a surprising number of horror films, especially horror films that have become fairly major franchises. Vertigo Entertainment, way back in the day, was one of the production companies behind The Ring and its unfortunate sequel. They were also involved in The Grudge along with Ghost House. They did Dark Water. If you remember that one with Jennifer Connelly, Dark Water is an underappreciated gem of the burst of Japanese to English adaptations. It is a bummer and a half.
And it's one of the only movies that I think really makes New York look like a hellhole.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Holy shit. I would never want to live there.
I don't want to live there. I don't want to be anywhere close. So they've been around for a long time. Their 2000s were definitely more successful than their 2010s. But Vertigo has been throwing money at horror projects for 20 something years. So makes sense that they would also get on board if this was a well-received script on the blacklist. So, again, I imagine that the budgeting was pretty tight. So maybe even with that limited box, they got what they needed out of it. I think this could have gone bigger, though. Like, this is the kind of movie that if they dropped it in the next 2 weeks and did like a relatively marginal ad spend, I think this thing could have pulled in 50 or 60 easy, like no problem. Because
there have been so many dumb horror movies that have had this kind of viral appeal almost.
Totally.
And I think this could have slotted in there, and actually people would have been tricked into seeing a good movie instead of something like
God
Smile.
God forbid. I have not seen the new Exorcist film. It is reviewing okay, and apparently it is. I think it's going to be a box office success, but I mean, they did a Monday Night Football ad spend for that thing. And you know, that does matter. Like, that gets people out to theaters still. Like, I would prefer that it didn't. It would be better if it didn't. But yeah, that thing's already pulled in 78 million. Oh, no, wait. Nope, wrong one. There's so many Exorcist movies. I can't find the one I'm looking for. Because I can't remember the name of it. Believer? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, not out yet, but that is trending that it's going to be pretty big. So I don't know, man. Like, I feel like this is a movie that if people had been given the chance to see it, I think it would have been fine. It's short, 88 minutes total, including credits. That means we are right at the theatrical runtime minimum Love it. Perfect choice. No notes. It is important for a film to not overstay its welcome, and this one does not. But anyway, interesting production, interesting history with the screenplay. Bowden, I think, is an interesting choice for the director, even though I don't know much about him. I think that he's got a good eye. There's a lot of interesting camera work going on here. A lot of rotating Dutch angle shots, which I think is intentional given how the film plays out. But this is a very capable little thriller. It's really, really good. And I kind of feel bad that a lot of people didn't get to see it on the big screen. Hopefully it will become yet another sort of indie horror classic that finds its life in the home media market. But let's talk about cast real quick before we get into the story itself. We've got Lizzie Kaplan, who gets lead billing here, which I think is warranted given her storied career at this point.
She's scary.
She is terrifying in this. Because she plays the unhinged mother, which with such skill that it is legitimately frightening. There is a scene about halfway through the movie where she is cleaning pumpkins, like emptying out pumpkins in the sink, that is legitimately terrifying. Yeah. And it's shot from behind. You just see her stabbing pumpkins with a knife. It's glorious. Like, it's the kind of shot that, you know, quite frankly, was really normal in sort of 60s and 70s horror, right? Rosemary's Baby, original Exorcist style horror, where it's more about the vibe and tone of the moment than it is about a particular scare, right? There's no violin sting at the end of it where she turns with a knife and it's like, me, you know, like there's none of that. It's just, this is literally, when it's just presenting an image and saying like, this is actually terrifying if you think about the mechanics of what's going on here. Which, as a person who, you know, has emptied out pumpkins in my life, that is kind of disgusting and terrifying when you think about what you're doing to this physical object, the hollowing out of a thing from the inside, which again, thematically plays very nicely. So Lizzie Kaplan, great, an unexpected choice for this, but she embodies the role and legitimately brings some malice and menace to it. Absolutely great. Following that, we have Anthony Starr, Homelander himself.
His face is scary.
I think one of the most, I'm a big Eric Kripke fan. I like The Boys a lot. I don't love it. I'm not obsessed with The Boys. I don't have any posters. I don't think about it all the time.
You don't base your entire personality on it?
No, I don't run around like trying to embody Carl Urban's butcher character with my physical life. But I really appreciate a lot of the work that's going on there. And one of the things that is truly terrifying about The Boys is the character of Homelander. And a lot of that has to do with what Anthony Starr does with his face.
Yeah.
Because Homelander himself is meant to be this Superman figure, of course. But it's the menace behind the eyes of Homelander in all of the scenes that make it work. Like, it wouldn't work without that. And that is on full display here. He is unhinged behind the smiling facade of this father. And it's brilliant. It's a brilliant performance. He's not in it a ton. He's a presence. Don't get me wrong. Like, he is a full character in this film. It's not like a cameo for dollars kind of situation. Like, he is fully invested in the father. But, It's
unsettling.
It's unsettling, and he brings so much to it in the limited screen time he has. Very, very, very good. There are some commonalities between. Well, I guess we need to talk about the legacy of bad parent films, right? Which is at this point a legitimate horror genre, right? We have the, you know, we actually have movies just parents, or mom and dad. Which mom and dad was that the. The one with Randy Quaid. They just remade that one not too long ago, didn't they? Mom and Dad was the one with Nicolas Cage. With him and Selma Blair. That's right. So that was a legitimate one. Then there was Parents with Randy Quaid in the 80s. That was the one that Bob Balaban directed, if I remember correctly. Yeah, that was the Bob Balaban movie. Another one where it's like, are the parents evil? Are they not? Is it the kid's perspective? You know, in that one, you know, the parents do end up being evil. Spoilers, I guess.
Spoilers for Parents from
89, maybe. And then even, you know, the sort of invasion films, the Body Snatchers films where the parents are, you know, taken over. What is the really famous one from the 80s that Joe Dante did, Invaders from Mars, the remake. Yeah, the 86 one, which that was not. That was Tobe Hooper. That was not Joe Dante. My bad. But yeah, like, you know, so we have this history in horror of, you know, like the parents have gone bad, right? Like it's a legitimate trope within horror. Because
if you can't trust your mom and dad, who can you trust?
Who can you trust? Like the world unravels in fiction, at least, if you don't have a mom and dad that you can trust. And that's where we find them in character of this film. So we've got Anthony Starr killing it as Mark. The mom's name is Carol. And then we have Cleopatra Coleman, who has done quite a bit recently as Miss Divine is her name. The substitute teacher, which I really enjoyed. Well, we're both educators, past educators, in some ways. And I always love when like substitutes show up in movies because it's made to be this like big to do, you know, like, oh, I'm the substitute. And everybody's like, ooh, it's like, no, in education, no one gives a shit about subs. Right.
Yeah.
And that's wrong. I don't think that's good. But the truth is the sub gets dumped off in the room and that's the end of it. Like if they get checked on by anyone else over the course of a day, then it's a lucky day. So there's a real kind of reality to it, I suppose. There's a real feeling of like, yeah, that feels real. Cause she just basically gets summarily dumped in the room by the principal and then he just leaves. And it's like, figure it out. But she is the rare, you know, sort of long-term sub that really wants to do a good job. And so she really starts trying to connect with the kids. And that leads to a connection with the boy, Peter, played by Woody Norman. And, you know, we've talked about kids on film before. Do you want to reiterate our typical stance of kids on film?
Nobody likes little kids.
Nobody likes little kids, and most little kids on film suck.
Yeah.
Real bad. But Woody Norman has had a bit of a year. He's been in a couple of things, including this. And I will say he's pretty good.
Yeah. He's not bad as far as little kids go.
No, he's pretty solid. A lot of this film is just silence and reactions. He doesn't have a tremendous number of lines, especially on the front half. He's staring at a lot of things. He's being bullied, you know, that kind of stuff. He was also in The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which I actually watched on the same night as this. Not a huge recommend on that one. it's not bad. It's really not. And the people who are at the lead of it are like, swinging for the fences. Like they are really excited to be in this vampire movie. David Dastalmachian is in it and he's really good. He survived way longer than I expected him to. Spoiler, I guess. But Woody the kid is also in that movie. He has a small role as the captain's nephew or something on the Demeter. So kind of a big year for Woody Norman, but solid, good performance, you know, not terrible kid actor. We would be remiss if we didn't also mention that there was another kid actor in this film. And what I'm going to ask you to do, dear listener, if you decide to watch Cobweb is just as the opening of the film is a, you know, series of images with the credits playing over them as is typical. What I'm going to ask you to do is to just close your eyes during those credits, right? Just cover them up because I don't want you to see this name in the credits as you go. Because in the credits, it's like, you know, kids playing in the classroom and the, you know, Peter's not involved because his life is terrible. It does establish the pumpkin patch in the back of the house. So I guess that's important. But there's a name. And if you miss it, it doesn't matter because the moment you see this kid's fucking face, you will know exactly whose Nepo baby it is. Because this film stars Luke Busey.
And that's not Jake Busey's son.
No.
It's Gary Busey's
son. It is Gary Busey's son. He's like 12 or something. And
it's not his fault. I just want to put that out there.
No.
I'm sure he's a nice little boy. And it's not
I'm
his
sure
fault.
He is. But I think he is, if this film is any indication, he has a long career of playing bullies and jackasses in front of him.
I can't wait for him to play a high school bully.
He's going to follow in the footsteps of Uncle Jake as best as he may try. Yeah, it's a Busey. He's got the Busey teeth and the Busey face. Kid is... And again, he's fine in this.
Yeah, he actually does play a really convincing little shithead.
he is super convincing as a bully little shithead. So we got a Busey in here, and then that's really it. We got a couple of other like bit players who come in just to do a couple of things here and there, but it's really the story of the parents, the kid, the bully, and the substitute teacher that cares. And that's kind of it. And, you know, it's really solid. Like it's hard for me to express without getting into like very specifics, which we'll do here in a minute. This is a really solid little horror film. I know Mike Stoklasa, I went back and watched their review after.
He was floored by this movie.
He was floored. Which I will be super honest, because apparently what Mike from Red Letter Media does is he just goes to Vudu, which I adore. That's like his video service of choice. And he just looks at what's new and he just picks shit at random and watches it. And what that does is that 99% of the stuff you're going to pick is awful. And I can imagine that if I just picked this, was like, oh, that looks interesting, and watched it with that, with like the zero or absolutely lowered expectations of what the Vudu marketplace would inspire, I can imagine walking away from this being like, my God, this is the best movie I've seen this year. Because like, imagine the shock and surprise, right? The awe of like, wait, no one's talking about this. No one's watched. What is happening? Because this is a movie to use an analogy more familiar with us, if I was just scrolling through Tubi and decided to watch the movie called Cobweb that was just sitting there, I would have been left devastated by this experience. Like, what the fuck is this? Everyone needs to know about this. Send the link out on social media to the direct line on Tubi. Like, just...
Get me Bill Tubi on the phone.
Get me Bill Tubi. We must talk about Cobweb. So I can see that having just a tremendous impact. But again, the movie has sort of been forced into that position because no one is aware of it. Like there was nothing to push people to go check this thing out. And so I'm 100% on board with that. Like, I think this is, it's easily one of the best horror movies I've seen this year. I mean, it's not like the competition has been stiff or anything, but, you know, I'm sure there'll be people who'll be like, I don't know, man, The Nun 2, that shit's pretty good. Like, you remember that scene where the magazines flipped and it made her face, and then there was a violin screech and everybody went, all right, like, you remember that? That was amazing. So, yeah, like I don't think there's been much released this year that of this level of quality. Like this is a well-made, well-shot, and well-acted bottle picture, and it's good. It's really good. So I hope it starts getting some accolades. I think it deserves to start getting some accolades because, you know, it's I don't know what it is about genre pictures like this, but when it can be bundled with surprise, like legitimate, like wow, like that is such an such a powerful feeling, right? To be legitimately like surprised. And I guess it's a function of the genre that most of it is so terrible that, you know, when you find one that's just okay, you're like, yay,
this movie was not bad,
it's good, you know. It is kind of shocking how that tends to happen, but yeah, so before we get into the spoilers, this is a big recommend for me. Absolutely find a copy of Cobweb and go check it out before we talk about it. Like, stop this podcast, go watch it before we spoil the shit out of it. and just sort of let it wash over you because it's really good. It's a refreshing kid focused. I'm not going to say that it's an 80s knockoff because it doesn't really have that vibe for me. I will say some of the shots at the beginning sort of reminded me of The Black Phone, you know, sort of like the color palette slightly washed out, the fall sort of colors. It felt a little bit Black Phone-ish and that it was sort of maybe reaching even back further to like the 70s.
But it also sort of has like a 2010s supernatural horror vibe.
Yes, absolutely. Sort of like, Conjuring era.
Yeah.
I know The Conjuring is set in the past, but like the Conjuring era of horror films, like it's definitely
from like a filmmaking perspective.
Right. Yeah. It's not trying. Right. Cause Black Phone, like the filmmaking in Black Phone was meant to be evocative of those like 1970s, 1980s, you know, kids on bikes pictures. Like that was part of it, but this isn't really trying to capture that vibe. It's shot like a modern film. It feels like a modern film, but it does sort of harken back to another type of horror picture in some positive ways. I think it does have great production design. The house is really good. It's sort of just the perfect level of livable and run down, which I think a lot of movies like this don't get. Like most like James Wan's Malignant would be a good example. Like the houses in Malignant are just like impossible and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like these houses would not exist. This feels very much like a house that could be lived in. It is run down and it is sort of ill kept, but in a way that you know lots of people still find livable, right? And so I think that that's a hard balance for production designers in Hollywood to get because, you know, they're given the directive, well, this house needs to look like shit. And so they go too far. And it's like, well, yeah, it's so bad that no one would live here and it would be condemned. Or if anyone came over and saw the conditions, this kid would be immediately taken away from his
parents.
Yeah. Right. Like that, it can't go that far. But is the paint all fucked up on the outside? 100%. Are the floors dirty and it's kind of filthy? 100%. But it's the livable kind. Right. And I really appreciated that because that can be a hard balance. Like, you know, again, people who work in the film industry don't always have that perspective, to pull upon, you know, whereas this one definitely seemed like it did. Okay. So, what do you think? Recommend from you too?
Yes. This was really surprising. I generally trust like half in the bag to kind of line up with what I like about movies. So I knew that this was a pretty safe bet. And it is, it's great. I watch a lot of horror movies and I have seen some good ones in the last few years. I feel like there are always some special ones, but I think this might be one of the special ones for 2023 because it did dawn on me. We're coming to the end of this year. So
somehow amazingly. Yeah.
So yeah, this might be one of the better horror films that I watched in 2023 for sure.
I mean, have you considered The Meg 2?
I have. I have. I'm always considering it, really. Never leaves my thoughts.
It never leaves my thoughts. Yeah, I mean, this is definitely up here for me. I mean, we did have an Insidious movie this year, which, you know, we've talked about doing some stuff about. I enjoyed the hell out of it. It's middle of the pack for the Insidious franchise. I mean, all five of them at this point, I guess. But I enjoyed it immensely. And I thought Patrick Wilson kind of killed it with some of his directorial choices in that movie. So that would be up there for me. But yeah, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of like really awesome horror. You mentioned Smile, which, you know, was fine until the ending was like, we have no idea what we're doing. idea what we want to do with this, so I guess we'll just end it with a month you know, kind of thing. I have heard a lot about Talk to Me. That's another one I want to check out. I have a copy of that that I'm hoping to check out this week, because that's from YouTubers. It's YouTuber horror.
Wow.
I know. But I have high hopes and it does look very good and has had a pretty solid response. I guess we did have Evil Dead Rise, but the fact that it didn't jump to mind is pr- probably telling for where I'm at on that one. But anyway, so yes, this definitely among the horror films that have been released in recent memory that I have retained the fact that they exist in my memory, Cobweb is pretty high on that list. And it gets there without like trying to do too much. Like this is a sparse film. There's not a ton of scares. There's not a ton of jumps. There's, you know, the sort of conventional things that you expect to exist in a film like this being released at this budget. You know, there are tricks that you do to make those movies feel bigger than they are. And this one seemingly makes active decisions to not do those things. And I really appreciated that. You know, it felt confident enough in its scares that it didn't have to use all of the standard modern horror tricks to make them work. We'll get into the ending, which I think is where, if you're going to poke a hole in this film, that's probably where.
Definitely.
But even with that, I feel like the movie builds it enough that I'm okay with it. I'm willing to go on that ride with them because the movie has such a great slow burn to get to that point. It's okay. So yeah, I guess let's jump into spoilers. Let's not beat around the bush. Again, if you haven't seen Cobweb, go to Vudu, I guess, and check it out. That's probably one of the better places to look for. I assume this is going to show up on a streaming service almost immediately, like within a couple of weeks. I imagine that it'll be, you know, part of Hulu normally does a big, like October horror month block. I think that may have already started actually. And they have a big, like, you know, chillers section and stuff. So this may be headed for that. I would not be surprised if it is. Or maybe to Max, who knows where, but this is going to show up on a streaming service as like a October scary movie pick very soon. I have no doubt. Again, that may have been the plan all along to do that. I don't know. But so keep an eye out for it. But if you do want to, you know, check it out immediately, then, and obviously it is available on most of the video on demand services. I think I even saw an ad for it on, Amazon Prime the other day. So I think it's on there too. But anyway, so spoilers, this movie opens really well. I think it wastes no time and I so appreciated that. Like, you know, we get the montage over the credits of him like being taught piano by the mother and it's awkward and weird and he doesn't feel connected at school and, you know, all of that stuff. But then we immediately start nighttime, bedtime, voice in the walls. Yes. Like that is so perfect.
It immediately just, I don't know, a voice in the walls. It's so simple.
It's a simple concept.
So intriguing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's one thing to say in Cobweb's favor is that it's taking what would ostensibly be very tropey horror things and spinning them just slightly enough that it feels fresh and you want to engage with it again. And that is not simple to do. You know, it's very easy to churn out a horror film that preys upon all of those sort of standard horror tropes and actions and activities and just make another one of those, but to actually take it and use them efficiently and effectively to craft new scares and new ideas, that I think is what sets Cobweb apart right away, right? Just immediately shifts it into another category. This is not an also-ran, right? It's not trying to do something that other horror films have done in the same way. And that is immediately an elevating choice, you know, in my opinion.
I agree. Yeah, this does feel slightly original. I don't want to say it's like an original idea because it isn't. I mean, most horror movies have like recycled concepts, but something about the arrangement of the concepts in this film feels like something I haven't seen before, or maybe I haven't seen in a very long time.
I think so. The fact that the voice in the walls Because I guess that's the setup. You know, we get this basically a montage of a day in the life of this kid. He's alone. He's distanced from everyone around him. And then our first real sort of scene with him is alone in bed in the middle of the night. And, you know, he hears not a voice at first, I guess, but a sort of scratching in the walls, movement in the walls that wakes him up. And then we get, you know, some really great, I think this movie has a lot of really good atmosphere for it. Its color palette is very green and very blue. I think it just has a really good sort of visual identity right at the jump that it maintains, you know, for the bulk of the film. And I think it just works super well for establishing mood and tone. The boy's room is just awkward enough, which again, I think is a hard thing to pull off. We've talked on this podcast before, like the Green Lantern movie where it's just the kids has like 17 Rubik's cubes and his walls are covered in Hot Wheels posters. You know, it's just like, this is a kid's room, you know, when most kids' rooms are not like that. And this kid's room is especially off-putting. Like there's a hand-drawn picture of his mom and dad on the wall, which is creepy as fuck. There's like some messed up jack-o'-lantern with a cat face, a single armoire. It's like an empty four-walled room. Like there's no closets, there's no nothing. It's just walls. Yeah. And then he has an armoire and a window and then his bed and that's it. And there's like a weird poster on the wall of what looks like a marionette, almost like a Pinocchio figure, which I think is interesting. And then like the wall of note, like the wall that he's hearing the noises from, just has these two globe sconces on it that no one would ever put them on a wall that way. Like ever. Like that would never be the lighting scheme for a room, but it's perfect in that it frames the wall perfectly. It's lit in this very uncomfortable way. It's an excellent series of small production design choices that I think do a lot to set up just how lonely this kid's world is, how empty it is, right? It just reinforces that emptiness because his room is empty. There's nothing in it. There's nothing warm about it.
It has no personality whatsoever.
None. And given where this film goes with its storytelling, that makes a tremendous amount of sense.
Yeah.
He wakes up in the middle of the night with these noises. He looks outside to see if it's anything and it's not. Goes and wakes up his parents, the mother, who, again, you know, Lizzie Kaplan is doing tremendous work here. We've talked about The Exorcist as a, you know, important moment in horror filmmaking many times. But one of the things that makes The Exorcist work is Anne Bancroft as this, like, beset upon mother. And
you mean Ellen Burstyn?
Ellen Burstyn, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, that's right.
I was watching something else with Anne Bancroft earlier. I mean, Ellen Burstyn, who is back for Exorcist The Believer. I'm sure she was very excited to receive that paycheck from Jason Blum. I say that to say, I think one of the things that is easily overlooked in the horror genre is the importance of sort of the mother figure and how the mother figure is portrayed. And how that sets a tone for a horror film, right? You know, Halloween is notable for its lack of parents, right? The parents are gone and these kids are alone. You know, whereas if the parents are present, who the parents are, how the parents behave is a huge part of how the horror gets generated. And just as Ellen Burstyn was essential to the functioning of The Exorcist, like The Exorcist doesn't work as a horror film unless you see the terror on her face. This film and the mother's sort of, she's never warm. Like Kaplan is always one step removed from genuine feeling for this kid. And that ends up being so important to what this film is about. And she just nails it. Like you get that it's, because for a minute, if you're a horror fan and you're watching this movie and you know nothing about it, which is the best condition, you're just going to think that they aren't his real parents.
Right.
Right. Like that seems to be where this is headed. Right. Because
that they're crazy people who abducted him.
They stole him. Right. Because there is talk early on of a kid who was killed over Halloween night, and you know, there was all this turmoil, and so was he like the other kid that wasn't, you know, was from the family? Or there's all this like, oh well, maybe it's you know, they stole him, they kidnapped him, they're hiding him. It's none of that. Like, it's none of that. It is his mom. That is his mom.
But that yet is at the who same she time, is.
That is his mom, right? And so there's this really cool line that she walks, and I think she maybe gives the performance of the film, to be honest. Anthony Starr is a very close second in my mind, but I mean, there's a point later in the film where she just becomes completely unhinged. She basically feels that she's being accused of being a bad mom, and she just loses it. Like, how, you know, the how dare she moment kind of thing. And it's, you believe it all. Like, it, you, she's truly doesn't think she's a bad mom, right? She thinks she's doing the work, and that is an interesting place for a character to be. So she's great. They identify that the knock in the wall, it's nothing. Don't worry, go to bed. And the story, you know, continues apace. Also, this movie is called Cobweb, and that means that there are indeed spiders. There are spiders in this. Just, I guess, it's a content warning.
I survived.
Yeah, it's okay. It's not bad. I got to the end of the movie and I was like, why is this called Cobweb again? And then
it makes sense.
It does. Eventually. It works. It eventually does indeed sort of all kind of come together, because it is both a combination of actual webs, like, you know, in dark corners and hidden passageways and walls and whatnot. But it also is sort of a web of deception, right? It's a web of lies. that is happening in this as well. But it's also just a creepy title for a horror movie, and we have to acknowledge that. You need a creepy title for your horror movie. One word titles are big right now. Oppenheimer, Barbie, so on and so forth. Cobweb. So why not just keep the train rolling when it comes to the naming conventions? But yeah, so the kid's life continues to unspool, and I don't know if we need to take it scene by scene. It basically just know that this kid's home life sucks. His parents are present.
These are bad people.
They eat around the dinner table every night. Like, all of the trappings of family are there, but there is a malice behind all of their actions that is inescapable and undeniable. And the kid absolutely knows that it's there, right? Like, he is not unaware of the fact that he is unloved within this space. Even though the mother constantly reinforces just how much he is loved, like constantly saying it, but he knows, you know, the truth, if you want to call it that. So I guess the next sort of major things that happen are that he continues to have encounters with the entity in the walls, eventually turning to conversation. And most of this really worked for me. I don't really know if I have a lot of like, you know, this is kind of silly. People in the walls stuff is always different. It's always hard for me mechanically, because I'm like, I know how walls are built, and
there are nobody, you know, in the walls.
There's nobody in the walls.
Nobody fits
like,
in there.
Like our house, like I'm like the wall that I turn to my right as I'm sitting at my desk recording right now. Is one of these massive false walls. There's a chimney that runs through it, which expanded the need for it, you know, how big it is. We have a closet embedded in it that sort of belies how thick the wall is, but there is a large section in the middle that probably has like a 2.5 foot, you know, space in it.
Have you checked it for?
You know, I haven't checked it for anyone in years, but I guess I should try. You know, just to see if we've got a wall friend.
I would add that to your yearly chore list, you know.
More than likely what's in there is an old buffet. Like, somebody had a buffet with shelving stuck in that thing and they just boarded it over when nobody needed it anymore. Because who does that? You know, but yeah, there's nobody in the walls. And I do have some issues with how the thing in the walls would be able to move around the house in the way that they do while also ostensibly being trapped and unable to escape. But we'll get to that. So on the second night that the entity presents itself, it's not mom who comes, it's dad. And dad is much less sort of like willing to just sort of soothe. He's like, oh, okay, we got some in the walls, huh? Well, we're just going to go get some poison out of the shed. We're just going to put poison everywhere at the house. We'll just put poison everywhere. Dad, why does it smell like cinnamon? So the rats will eat it, son. You know, like that kind of thing. But I really love the subtle framing. When they go to the shed, you know, the kid goes inside to get the poison, and then Anthony Starr's just silhouetted in the door, and he just looks like a slasher villain, right? He's got the high-collared coat. I'm not going to say that Samuel Boden is like treading new ground in terms of horror photography, but he's using all of the tools in the toolkit really effectively to continually reinforce that even though you're having scenes where the dad is like being nice and, oh yeah, we're going to catch the rats in the walls, don't worry about it, son, you know that this dude is bad. Like there's something wrong here. And that's important. You know,
it reminded me a little bit of the first half of The Shining when Jack Nicholson is just a bad father instead of also a murderer.
Right.
And crazy. When they're just interacting, he's not doing anything. Like in most of those scenes, Jack Nicholson is not doing anything wrong, but he's so scary. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Starr really picked up on the same thing. Where he can make these kind of mundane, seemingly normal moments feel awful.
Yeah, it's even as he's explaining what rats are to the kid, like why they need to be killed. Because the kid's like, well, why, we don't need, you know, we have to kill them? And he's like, well, they're pests, right? They spread disease. They're not worth our concern. And so like it just, nothing he's saying is inaccurate or wrong or bad necessarily, but
it's scary.
What he chooses to emphasize and how he chooses to explain this concept to his young son is just, it's malicious and terrifying. I did want to comment though, one thing I had written down in my notes was the lighting in this is really well done inside of the house.
I agree.
Just strong shafts of light always in the background in various places because the home itself is extremely dingy, you know, but there will always be like a really strong point of light, which then when he goes to school or he leaves the home, the light becomes much more saturated and universal, almost like moving into the home. The only strong light comes from outside the home. There is no source of good, strong, consistent lighting inside this kid's house. And that feels very intentional to me. Like everything is diffuse and in shadow and silhouetted. And so like basically the only goodness in the world is coming from outside the home, you know? And I really liked that as a subtle sort of, you know, production design trick. That feels like somebody got the memo about what this place is supposed to feel like kind of thing. And that's really good. So the kid continues to kind of bond. We're told at the beginning of the film that this is a week before Halloween. That's when all these events start. And then so we're kind of building to Halloween night. The final night of the film is Halloween night. So it's a week, 7 days. And so over the course of the 7 days, young Peter bonds very quickly with his teacher. She sees him drawing. He has some artistic skill. You know, we see that right at the beginning, the drawing of mom and dad. So he's an artist. And so they're painting or doing watercolor or something in class. And he draws himself in bed at night with someone in the walls saying, help me. Now she misinterprets and believes that it's Peter saying, help me. I don't think it's him saying it in the picture. I guess have to review it. I think it's coming from the walls. But again, we get this. Yeah, it's coming from the walls. But we get this idea that the teacher is legitimately concerned for Peter's well-being, tries to approach the parents, which again would probably never ever happen in real life, but again, it's a movie. It believes that teachers would maybe do that, I guess. And I'm sure there are teachers who would. You would be pretty much immediately fired if you tried, but sure. So she shows up and the mom just like hand waves everything, keeps the picture. And then, of course, it becomes a bone of contention with Peter, where she's like, you are speaking outside of the home, sir. And I feel like that resonates.
Yeah.
I get that. I've had that conversation. Oh, you were talking about what happens inside our house, huh?
Yeah.
You know. And so, again, Kaplan is so good in this because, you know, her tone of voice, her facial expressions are like, I understand why you might do this, son, but don't ever do this again or I will kill you. Like there's a lot unstated here, and she's done a very good job of building this. But then, of course, there has, you don't put a Busey in this film unless he's going to be a little shit. And little Busey decides to take Peter's very ornate and lovely pumpkin and just smash it for no reason, just because he's a little butthead. And, it's a lovely little montage, I suppose, of Peter being beaten down by this bully. And then, you know, the substitute teacher finds out and Peter is forced to make amends. But not before the voice in the walls offers some advice to Peter about how to handle this bully. So what's the advice? The voice in the walls that Peter's been listening to that wants his help and sounds very sweet and very kind, suggests what?
Fuck that kid up.
That's right.
And does it in a really sweet way, too. It's like, yeah, I bet you could stand up to him.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you could take him down if you just tried. But really, it's kind of sinister.
Yes.
And this is where,
yeah, totally. And this is where you're supposed to, as an audience member, you know, sort of begin to understand that maybe the voice in the walls, which is painted as a sympathetic figure, right? I just want to get out. I'm trapped here. I need help. Well, now maybe the voice in the walls isn't all good.
Has other interests.
There's some motive here. Yeah, there's some intentionality behind what the voice is trying to pull off. But apparently, you know, somebody saw, we see there's like a girl on a swing set who sees what the bully does to Peter. And either that gets around or it gets back to the teacher. And so Peter is forced to make amends by bringing Peter another pumpkin to replace the one that he broke. And I just, again, subtle details in film can do so much to build the world, but I absolutely love that. I think his name's Brian. I'm just going to call him Busey. I love that Busey's mom is like this. She like walks him in and hands on shoulders, and she's just so proud of her little angel who just, you know, he just made this little mistake. He just made this little like oopsie where he knocked him down and broke his pumpkin. And you can just see like, oh, I get why this kid's a piece of shit. like, you know, it just like some subtle work being done on the part of the director and the mom here to be like, yeah, okay, you get why this kid's a trash bag. But really all of that builds the school day ends, you know, the Busey kid has made his amends for the day. And then there is a confrontation in the school stairwell. And rather than, you know, just sort of accept his fate, Peter decides to fight back, and he pushes the Busey kid down the stairwell. And we get, honestly, one of the better, like, compound fractured broken legs I've seen in film in a while. That kid's leg is like completely separated from
Looks
the
like
rest
he won't
of it.
Play football after all.
Yeah, I don't think his NFL career is gonna work out. And I gotta say, is screaming genetic? Because hearing that tiny Busey scream was so evocative of hearing both his uncle and his father scream in film for decades that I have to believe. I mean, this is a real like nature versus nurture question for me. Like I legitimately was listening to it. I was like, my God, that could be Gary Busey screaming in Predator 2. Like it's the same,
you know,
it's the same sound.
Blood is
the same. I just like, you just don't think about it, right? You're like, no, of course that's not. It's a learned behavior. Like nobody genetically screams, but this movie, I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah.
Cause there is definitively now proven over three separate people in decades worth of film that when a Busey screams, it fucking sounds like this. Like that's what it sounds like. And it's just like, damn. But yeah, so he gets his leg broken and obviously this causes tremendous issues. And I appreciated this too, because again, most of the time school misbehavior is so sort of white glove treated in film where you can basically get away with anything. And there'll be like movie consequences. Like you have to go to detention or something. But like, if you do physical violence or harm to another student and get verifiably caught doing so, like that's a grounds for expulsion. They just kick you out. Like you just don't go to school anymore. And so that's what happens. Like he gets kicked out of school and his parents decide to homeschool him. Ouch. And we get our first fight between mom and dad. Because mom failed to disclose the events of the picture to dad. I love once that is revealed, like dad's entire, like his entire emotional state shifts. Like it's a seismic internal shift. Like, wait, what? What picture? What now? What are you saying? And he begins to, again, as the context of the film is expanded and we know more and more about what's going on here, like his fury, while somewhat justified, I'll say a little bit, like when he realizes that this isn't something isolated, that maybe this is a result of the thing in the walls, everything changes. Like it's just everything changes. And that's when he pushes aside the refrigerator to reveal a little door in the wall that goes down to a secret basement that is full of danger and darkness. And I was going to ask you this. Do you think Peter knew that this thing existed?
I feel like because when the movie started, it's not, and this was something that the movie did differently from other films that I really liked, was that when it starts, they don't have a good relationship. It's not like the family is perfect and then one day everything changes.
No,
their relationship is terrible. Everything is bad. This is an abusive home from the very start. It just continues to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just gets worse. Yeah,
so I think he probably did know something was there and just kind of lived around it.
I would have to think so. But so this leads to a little basement, a kind of, it doesn't look like a full basement necessarily, but it's a section that's been, you know, dug out underground. And they put him down there. There's like one light bulb, some cobwebs, again, justifying the title of the film. And they just put him down there, close the door, put the refrigerator back, and just leave him down there in the dark for what he's done. And
it's scary.
Again, this is where the movie, like, if you didn't kind of see what was going on, that this was, if you still sort of imagine that this was an okay family, now you get it. Like, now it's like, oh, okay, no, this is horrible and abusive and terrible, and these people suck, and they just leave him down there for days, I guess, like at least one, if not two, enough time for the teacher to both notice that he's gone, but also to, what does he do? I forget what the inciting event was. she finds out something about like the missing children. The principal maybe says something to her about like,
yes,
there was a kid that went missing in that area. Maybe it's, you know, it's justified she, like, that the parents would be protective or whatever.
She like Googles it and reads about it or something.
Right. Because we need our character discovering things from the library in the past or whatever. Like we can't have a horror movie without that at this point. Yeah, she like Googles missing children and finds the story and, you know, sort of like begins piecing some things together. And so she basically, she just refuses to like sort of forget that this kid exists, which is really sweet and ends up being sort of very important. So she goes and checks on him the next day again, and again, Lizzie Caffel is just killer because there's the scene of her in front of the washing machine and she's just standing there, just staring at the washing machine as it works. Like she has so little going on in her life that like this is the content of her day. But the teacher hatches a plan to try and help Peter if he needs it. So he again leaves school very suddenly, like, you know, he wasn't supposed to leave. So she has a math test of his that had not yet been graded. So she hatches a scheme to go check on him by, you know, under the pretense of delivering this final math test to Peter's family. But she puts her phone number at the top of it as if it's part of the grading process or something. So again, I'll grant it, this is a pretty clever move for the teacher. Like, I like at horror movies where teachers, you know, or characters in general, but a teacher character specifically has a little bit of agency, like comes up with something to truly like move the needle instead of just being concerned or whatever. And that's what happens here. But of course she gets invited into the home because dad is just such a nice guy. He's just doing a little bit of work around the house. So just come on in, just hang out.
I just want to know why she went in. It felt bad. It felt wrong. Why'd you go in there?
Right. You know, you get the feeling that she's like very committed to checking on this kid and that's good. But
hey, this, it's not worth your life. Is it?
This scene is,
maybe it
this
is.
Scene is. Oh my God. This scene is great though, because it spools out of control immediately. Like Lizzie Caplan gets this look on her face, like she just wants to murder her. And Anthony Starr all of a sudden has just like a giant bleeding wound on his arm. like he's just dripping blood everywhere. And he claims that it was a construction accident, that he was working around the house and caught it on a nail or something, which also justifies why he's just carrying around a claw hammer. Like he just has one. It's just there. And of course it's menacing and, you know, mildly terrifying. But the whole scene, it's just, again, I think Bowden has like a really good sense of how to shoot this kind of like subtle and awkward series of exchanges, right? Where nothing said is overtly wrong or incorrect or out of place, but everybody is just bringing their A game in terms of the sort of multiple layers of information that are being exchanged. You know, the best directors can film scenes like this with layers of complexity to them and make it seem as if it's effortless. And I really feel like this falls into that category. It is not easy to both demand these performances of your actors, figure out a way to block and shoot it effectively, which I really like that for the most part, he shoots this in singles. We get one sort of semi-wide to establish where everybody is in the room. And then after that, it's singles. It's just like, here's Lizzie Caplan. Here's the response. Here's the dad. Here's the response. And it keeps everybody kind of boxed off and separated and isolated from each other, but yet very connected via their eye lines and via the sort of subtleties of their performance and confirmation. And then the dad is the one that moves between the scenes. Like the dad is the only one, like if I'm not mistaken, I'd have to rewatch it again, but I remember noting this the first time I watched it, that the mom and the teacher are never in the same frame. They only share the frame with the dad. Like, it's like these two are not on the same page. Like they are not together. They are isolated from each other. And it was just a nice, again, what is it? Like something like 80% of any film is people talking to each other.
Yeah.
And you can either do that from like a really boring, here are these people sitting at a table talking, or you can really truly try and use those moments to tell and reinforce more aspects of the story. And it feels like Bowden is doing that. Like, and again, if he's doing that intentionally and purposefully, great. If he's just kind of naturally feeling that these are the rhythms that work, then even better, because that's a Spielberg for me. That's what Spielberg does. Spielberg can make a scene. I watched The Post. That's just scenes of people in rooms talking to each other. That's the whole movie, man. That's it. And it's still one of the, it's a thrilling film to watch. And so the coda we do get, I mean, this film is not high on jump scares, but like the biggest jump scare is post that, where she's like in her car looking for her keys and she bends down, the camera pans with her, and then she comes back up and he's just there occupying the entirety of the window with her keys. Glorious, just glorious, glorious. I also love she drives a Dodge Neon. I think that's perfect. Dodge Neons are exactly what a substitute teacher in a small town would drive.
Yep.
I 100% agree.
I think I drove my Dodge Neon when I was a substitute teacher.
It's the perfect substitute vehicle. It's efficient. It's kind of fun to drive. It's comfortable. I mean, it's just exactly what you would want out of a modern American car. Anyway, so the day passes. The substitute teacher 100% hears the banging. Because the kid comes up and starts kicking at the door to try and when he realizes that there's somebody else in the house, she 100% hears it. The mom passes it off as if it's the washing machine, which, you know, again, ties the whole thing together that we've got the thump of the washing machine going. And then mom, and again, man, just Lizzie Kaplan, I cannot speak highly enough that she goes down to get him out of the basement and she's made cupcakes and she's trying so hard to be kind, but you can tell that it's a struggle. Like she doesn't know how to treat him well.
Don't know how to be nice to you.
I don't know how to love you kind of thing. And it's just so creepy and off-putting. Like I cannot emphasize how much that adds to the film, how just off-putting both of these performances are. And then I wanted to ask you about their bathroom, which we did get a glimpse of.
It's huge.
Earlier in the film. It is massive. And I, you mentioned The Shining earlier with Anthony Starr's performance. Mm-hmm. I got real Shining vibes out of the slow push in.
I did too.
I was going to ask if you read that the same way I did. It's not, I mean, there's no color, you know, there's no color similarities. There's none of that green of the room 237 bathroom,
don't need it.
You don't. It's the archer. It's the archway above the top of it. The sort of framing, and again, it's that slow push that Kubrick does into that bath, as you know, it's Jack being pulled into that environment and that world. And we get the same thing here as mom is sort of washing the boy in the bathtub. Which again, this kid's like 10, 11. Like mom ain't washing you in the bathtub anymore. It's creepy. It's weird. Everything's wrong. It's all wrong. Everything's bad. Like, it's just like, you don't know how many times you can say it. But then the sort of last shot of the two of them together as they put him to bed, we get the silhouetted shadows on the wall surrounding him as he's laying down. Just great. All great. And then of course the voice in the wall escalates and then he has his dream. Was it a dream? Is it what, you know, hard to say how much of it's real, how much of it's not. I really liked this dream sequence. Generally, I hate dream sequences in horror movies because they're super obvious and you know how they're going to end with a screeching violin, a cutaway or something like it's it's a horror trope at this point that you're going to have a dream of where somebody sees weird shit and then you get a bunch of jump scares and then they wake up and it's morning and there's eggs on the table or something. But this one, I feel like one, it's earned in the script because it's the kid psychologically reconciling with the fact that he doesn't trust his parents anymore. that he no longer believes that they care about him at all. Like you feel like he's been living on this tiny thread of belief that they still care about him, but that has been ripped away. And now he knows, because of this experience in the basement or whatever, that they don't care about him. And so they become the villains of the piece. They are the monsters. Which again, Anthony Starr, it's a simple action. He's standing in the corner blinking at a high rate while we get some noise, you know, and then just some really great, you know, Lizzie Kaplan and some weird contact lenses in the darkness. And then more Dutch angle spins, which again are becoming kind of the Dutch angle slow spin is like a really consistent thing that gets paid off in the last, you know, 20 minutes of this movie or so. But I really liked this dream sequence, which I never ever say I enjoyed that dream sequence in a horror film, because they're usually almost always super obvious and stupid. Yeah,
usually dream sequences just don't feel enough like dreams.
Also true. Yes, they're still just story bits being relayed into the context of a dream. Yeah,
but this really does feel like a dream. And like the worst possible dream you could have.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a terrible, terrible, terrifying dream that continue, you know, it serves the function again of isolating him further from his parents, as he doesn't trust them anymore, because the final sort of, you know, spin camera move takes him to waking, and he sits up in bed at the point where his, you know, the mother character was about to kill him. And then he's being hugged, like she's embracing him because he was screaming in his sleep. But then, you know, the plot has to kick in eventually, right? Because right now we've really just been tone setting more than anything else for a good, you know, 30 minutes of this. But finally, the voice in the walls. The voice in the walls starts revealing sort of crucial information, right? There's something in the backyard in the pumpkin patch, and the pumpkin patch is bad. Like they need to,
pumpkins
need to,
are rotten.
Yeah. There's something stinks in the state of Denmark. this kind of thing. And, he tries to call the teacher, gets caught, because he finds a dead body in the pumpkin patch.
Yeah.
A skeleton, and is caught finding said skeleton by the mother, who, you know, again, Kaplan's doing a great job here, because she's withholding information from the father, knowing that if the father knew that the kid knows, she wouldn't have a son anymore. Like that seems to be the implication. But then we get the pumpkin scene in there too, which again, love the pumpkin scene. You need to make a meme out of that one. We'll create a TikTok meme of just mom massacring pumpkins. But then she realizes that he's talking to something in the walls, and mom like truly loses it. Like Lizzie Kaplan is backing away. She's terrified. She's just wait till your father gets home. And then like,
well, because this whole time you wonder if, is this really happening? Like mm-hmm. as an audience, you're not really sold on the person in the walls yet, like as a real thing, or that the parents know about it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when they put him in the basement, it starts to feel like, oh yeah, I bet that could be a person in the walls, but you're still not really sure what's going on. Like what exactly happened to get them in this situation. And it's only when she catches him and realizes that he's talking to someone that, you know, it's cemented like, oh shit. So they really did put someone in the walls. Who the fuck is this?
Right. And we did see in the basement, he's exploring a bit, and there is like a pit with a cage, and there's like a stuffed animal down there, a stuffed animal with human teeth or what seemed to be human teeth.
Yeah. What's that all about?
I don't know what that's about.
I don't know where you can buy those.
No, I mean, I know they make those, what are the Fugly dolls or whatever, and some of those have like weird looking plastic teeth, but Yeah, like it's real. It's real creepy. So things escalate. You know, the dad kind of knows that the kid knows, and then eventually the kid reveals that he is aware that he has a sister, because the voice in the walls reveals that I'm your sister, and I was bad, or mom and dad didn't love me anymore, so they trapped me in the wall, and there is a door behind the big grandfather clock in their bedroom that if he can open it, that he could set her free and they could be happy together.
It's all wrong.
And then I really do like that Peter says, I want to see you. And then she's like, oh no, I've been in the walls too long. You'd be scared. You wouldn't like the way I look. And he's like, no, I want to see. And then we do get a little bit of a jump scare there. But again, like it's all very plausible. Like this kid is really beset upon this thing's being nice to him. Now it says they have a relationship and that they could be together and maybe his life would improve. And so Peter takes the next logical step and he murders his parents. which I loved this. They're having family dinner and everybody's like, why does this porridge or weird soup that I'm eating taste so strange? And he's like, what does it smell like? And I was like, it's kind of like cinnamon. And the dad realizes that Peter has spiked the family meal with the rat poison from the shed. And again, this is a slow build film. We've had no moments of real horror, nothing substantial anyway. And then from this point on, that changes.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Stuff starts moving fast.
Moving fast. And so the dad, Mark, Anthony Starr, he realizes very quickly, oh, what have you done, Peter? You need to call 911, Mama. And then Mom goes to grab the phone and realizes that the phone has been cut. And the phone line's been cut and nobody's calling for help. And so Mom grabs a knife and seemingly is chasing after Peter. But at the end of her life, as she begins vomiting all of the blood in her body up, she just says, you can't believe her, right?
Yeah, don't let her out.
Don't let her out. You can't let her out. You know, and sort of like this final realization of what has happened, right? That the voice in the walls has convinced Peter that this is the only way. And Peter believed because Peter's miserable and he hates his parents.
Yeah, like these are terrible people. And you don't feel bad for them that they've died. But also now you realize the alternative might be worse.
Exactly. Like he did within the context of the film. I'm not telling anybody to murder your parents if they treat you bad.
Yeah, please don't murder your parents.
I'm not endorsing parent murder, fratricide, patricide, matricide, you know. No, don't. But this film, all of these issues could have been rectified with the parents being kind to their child, right?
Yeah.
Like legitimately kind to their child. But they elected not to. And we quickly find out what the real situation is because Peter immediately takes the keys. Mom gives one final admonishment, like, don't let her out. Don't do it. Just don't. And he doesn't listen. And he goes and he knocks over the grandfather clock and he lets his sister out of the walls. And here's where the title of the film comes starkly into focus, because Peter's sister is not a sweet, kind, nice sounding little girl trapped in the walls. She's a monster. And being in the walls has only made her more of a monster.
Yeah. She's like covered in cobwebs.
Covered in cobwebs, spiders in her hair. She's got Samara ring hair.
It's kind of like matted.
Yeah, it's gross. It's not like nicely coiffed hair. It's nasty, but it's super long. It's like several feet of hair. It just full of spiders, full of cobwebs. But she's also, because she's been trapped in this space for so long, she has adapted. And now she's portrayed by a contortionist who's walking on all of her limbs like a spider, right? But she can like climb walls. She can grip with her feet. You know, this is where I think, you know, if you stuck with what this movie was doing for all this time, this is that sort of like big horror fan payoff. Personally, I would have been totally happy with something much more mundane. Like it's just a crazy, you know, sort of like middle-aged woman that has been trapped in the walls that, you know, was significantly older than Peter, or something like that. I would have been fine with that as the reveal too, instead of, you know, an actual monster. But I understand that the modern horror landscape demands a monster in a situation like this, right? Yeah. You know, I get it. And this is a pretty good one, right? Because she's also malformed. So the pieces that have been set up over the course of this film, which there are not many of them, this is not a complicated script to keep track of all the different moving parts, but the implication is whatever this Holden Field murder where the kid disappeared, the family, there's also a big to do earlier in the film about nobody goes out on Halloween, right? We don't do Halloween. And Peter's like, oh, I could dress up as this and I could be this. And they're like, we don't do that. The implication is that they had this little girl who was not normal. You know, she had a big mouth full of sharp teeth or whatever. And they took her out on Halloween, ostensibly the one night that she could be out, right? This is my thinking. This is not explained. They took her out. She murdered a kid. She straight up murdered him. And they covered it up, buried the body in the backyard with the decaying pumpkins. And then there was an implication that they moved. They lived in a different house, right? When that happened. So they must have moved to this house with the intent of setting up a space where she could be chained or constrained.
I don't actually know. I don't know.
Again, left ambiguous and rightly so. It doesn't really matter for what we're doing here. But like basically the parents have been covering up this their daughter's existence from the beginning. And now they know what she's capable of. So they trapped her in the walls. Then they had Peter, you know, later in seemingly an attempt to like, you know, start over. But the experience of having the other child, I guess, made them concerned about what Peter might become, I guess. And so they treated him like shit and then ended up turning him into a kid that would murder them. So he lets her out. And then we get to the part of the film where, again, if you're going to get lost at a part of this movie, this might be it, right? Because it's a bit of a big swing. This is a pretty big shift. We need a body count, right? You don't have a monster without a body count, and you can't have Peter die, at least not yet. So who shows up? Who shows up?
The bully brigade.
It's the bullies. It's Busey and his buddies. They're in festive Halloween masks of various animals. And they show up to just like, I don't know, honestly know what the plan is here. Like, I know they're there to fuck shit up. Like, that's what they're going to do. But I mean, it's obviously Peter has parents. Like, he has people that he lives with. Did they think they were just going to walk into the house and just beat the shit out of everybody? I guess. I don't know. But so at this point, the monster has been unleashed. She opens the door to let them in. She hides the bodies of mom and dad poorly, but still. And these bullies proceed to get moited, just dismantled.
It's really something.
Yeah.
It's very violent.
Yeah. There's a kid. It's a great shot. Cause there's one of them. He gets pulled under, like mom has a piano and they start trashing the piano for some reason. And then the kid gets like yanked underneath it. And then there's just an explosion of blood.
Big like, blood explosion.
Like just absolute, like they must have had just like a 15 liter cannon of of particulate under there that they just went.
I mean, and it has an appropriately like splashy sound where it's just, ooh, it's a lot of blood.
Yeah, it's just, it's crazy. So, you know, the bullies all get dismantled in very, you know, satisfying ways. They sort of quickly pick up on the fact that something's wrong. All right, there's blood, there's crap everywhere. Like something has happened in this place, but it, you know, they're either too stupid or too focused on, you know, breaking things really do anything about it. And so Peter's sister, we kind of get the full array of her powers, her abilities to crawl on the wall, to move quickly. And then the fact that she has an incredible array of sharp, dangerous teeth in a mouth that is far too large for her body. It worked a little bit against the film because there's a really bad Hulu horror film called Grim Cuddy. That is based on that. You remember that? It's the sculpture from the Japanese artist that was like the deformed, like demon face that was going around. It was a little bit bird. It had kind of a big smile.
Yeah.
Was it like Momo or something? It was this weird like thing that had a little bit of meme potential. Well, they took that idea and then turned it into this terrible Grim Cuddy film. It's bad because it's boring. Like, it's just so boring. But the creature they came up with was this like weird, almost Tim Burton-esque looking thing. It would like had really tiny legs and a super big upper body and then this weird face. And the face of the sister, even though you never really get a good look at it.
You get one quick shot of it.
Right. Which is smart, right? If you don't have money for the high dollar prosthetics, don't show me the thing.
And
because that was Grim Cuddy's problem. Grim Cuddy was very obsessed with showing this thing, and they shouldn't have been because it looked awful.
No, it's
and
awesome.
her face was a little bit like that, just a little, but way, 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 way better and shot better and you know, generally much better. So the bullies get dismantled. The teacher gets the idea to come and check on Peter. I don't remember, did he call her again? I don't remember what got her there, but she decides that she's going to come and help Peter. The sister traps Peter inside the walls, right? He gets his own wall treatment, I guess. And, you know, then it becomes, you know, will the substitute teacher and Peter escape kind of thing. And it's great. I mean, all of this stuff, it's really effectively shot horror. The lighting is really handled well. It's appropriately sort of dark. We get a couple of nice little, you know, she's on the wall behind her and you can barely see her in frame kind of stuff. I mean, everything that you would hope for out of a pretty solid horror action sequence. And it works, you know, it's all good. Like, it's all perfectly good. I think it's more ramp up than this movie needed to have, honestly. Like, it didn't have to go this far to still be satisfying and effective, but it's fine. Like, the whole thing culminates with Peter Rapunzeling himself out of the tunnel in the bottom of the house by climbing on her hair up out of the tunnel and then trapping her inside this cage that presumably that's what they used to have her in, I guess, was they had her down there and then maybe she was, you know, got capable of getting out
or something,
but she somehow got into the walls and they just kept her trapped there. You know, but they get her trapped in this cage and we get a nice little ending because, you know, how do you end something like this? They don't want to kill the monster because sequel. I mean, like, let's be honest. These types of movies are prone to sequels, you know, like it comes back again. I don't know if this one needs it. I'd be fine if they didn't. I probably prefer it if they didn't. But the monster, the sister, she gives a monologue at the end about how you can't leave me here. You know, I'll get out. And then every creak in the floorboards, every knock in the walls, you'll be afraid it's me. And all of that's played out over a scene of obviously future Peter, who has moved in with the substitute teacher as his new parent. And
I gotta say, I really loved that the bedroom that he's in that little flash forward of being with her, like it's this completely warm, personalized space that looks like a bedroom for a child. That
totally,
it's in such contrast with the house that he was in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a really subtle, very effective production design choices in this thing. Just very, very capably handled. Yeah, like the bedroom, he's got one of those little like touching the plasma balls where you put your fingers on it. Like the stuff that you would hope to see in a little kid's bedroom. He's got nightlights everywhere, little owls and stuff. Just it's books on the, you know, like, 'cause he didn't even have books, you know, like it's a much better environment. Like you can tell he's improved, but yet he will be haunted by this thing for forever. Although, I mean, at some point, somebody's got to call the police, right? Like, somebody's got to call the cops and be like, yo, there's a monster in this thing.
I've been hearing a lot of screaming next door. I don't know what's going on.
I mean, there are neighbors. People have been driving by in cars. Like, presumably somebody's going to see, like, oh, there's blood everywhere and there's a monster in the basement. But it's a nice ending. It leaves it on its little stinger of the monster returning kind of thing, which, again, is just an unfortunate... It is an unfortunate reality of horror films that they need to leave it open like this. But yeah, this was such a surprise, such a great little horror flick, enjoyable, knew exactly how long it had to sort of play the story out, wasted nothing, and really sort of told an effective and quiet little horror story, you know?
Didn't try to do anything extra.
Yeah,
it didn't really try to set up a franchise. It didn't really try to create this like deep lore and backstory around this monster girl. It just let it wrap up. But it's like, well, that's the end. Thank you for watching Cobweb.
Right, exactly. It's like, appreciate your time. Thanks for being, you know.
I hope you liked it.
So yeah, just nothing but high praise. I think, if this is Samuel Boden's like first sort of major horror experience, or, you know, major directing experience, I think he will be a director to watch moving forward. Like I said, I know he's done some smaller stuff. He had like a Batman, like fan film that he was attached to, Batman Ashes to Ashes, which I have like vague recollections of being a thing, but this is a very adept hand. This is a very capable director who deserves to be watched. But as we move into spooky season, I'm as of right now, this and Insidious: The Red Door, if you haven't seen it, are my two top horror recommendations of the year.
I'm probably about the same. Because, man, I love a good Insidious movie. I really enjoyed that.
Dude, I showed, again, as I've noted, my partner is not a huge horror film person, but occasionally I'll show her some things and be like, oh, check out this shot. The shot of him in Insidious of the Red Door, just to specify, there's a shot of him, the film opens with a funeral. I won't say who, just spoilers. But it opens with a shot of Patrick Wilson in the car, and he's, you know, having a text conversation, and God, I love my text conversations and films on screen. I love when directors do it. I love seeing how they're going to do it and what their approach is. It's so good. But he's sitting in the car, he's texting his kid, and there's just like, there's a person standing in the background, right? Just standing there, deep focus. You know, there's a person, you can't see who it is. You can't see what they're doing. They're just there. And then they start walking toward the car. And they're walking toward the car. They get a little bit closer and a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And he has no idea they're there. And then he leans over and comes back up and they're gone. And I love that shit. That is so,
so good.
And that movie is full of that kind of stuff. And I liked it a lot. But yeah, this is right up there. The other only name I wanted to note here is that this was actually edited by Kevin Greudert. Yes. Famous film editor, Kevin Greudert. But
I'm sorry. But, I don't doubt you. I just,
but Kevin Greutert is most famous for his contributions to the Saw franchise. He was the editor on all of the Saw movies from one on until he started directing Saw movies, of which he directed both 6, 3D, and he is also directing the forthcoming Saw X or 10. So Greutert is an interesting editor choice for this, and I wonder if it was one of those like, oh, we'll just call Kevin kind of things, you know. I don't know, but it was just another name that stood out in the credits. I was like, Kevin Greutert, because I've watched way too many Saw movies too many times. But yeah, just really solid. And again, the score is also really good. It's done by Italian trip hop composer Drum and Lace, who are pretty cool in and of themselves. I'm not super familiar with all of their discography, but I've definitely had them come up on my like rando play me stuff that I might like playlist. Drum and Lace has definitely been on there. So pretty extensive, you know, history of film composition over the last 10 years or so. But I really enjoyed this. It was not a score that like drew attention to itself or stood out, but it was very appropriate and very perfect for the moments in which it was employed. So enjoyed that too. But all right. So I guess we can wrap up. We could go on being, you know, applying effusive praise to this film, but I think it's pretty clear at this point that this is, if you are a horror aficionado and you're looking for something, Cobweb is probably going to fit that bill, unless you're one of those weird Eli Roth motherfuckers that just want to see people get their eyes popped out or something. But yeah, I 100% recommend Cobweb. Absolute joy of a film. Glorious little project. Loved every minute of it.
Yeah, this was really unexpected, and I don't know. I know we've talked about this before. We watched these, you know, small, quiet horror films, and we both are like, why can't they all be like this?
It's true, yeah.
And I'd like more like this. You know, this movie wasn't perfect, but it's kind of a relief from the completely generic horror films, or like even worse, the things that are like a bid to go viral online, like the Megan movie. Mm-hmm. You know, which is whatever. It's, you know, it's nothing against that movie in particular.
No,
it's
I'm not gonna be against
you're not
Megan.
Gonna defend
it's fine.
Megan. But you know, it's just it's nice. It's nice to see something that's just working really well within the constraints that it's given itself. Like, this is the movie that we're trying to make. We're not trying to do anything bigger than that. Just enjoy.
Yeah.
Way, it kind of reminded me of like John Carpenter.
Totally. We've talked numerous times that sometimes all a film needs to be, you know, and you know, Roger Ebert would say this all the time to Siskel. He's like, you have to meet the film where it is. Like, you have to meet the film on the terms of its engagement. Because, like, I think they got in a big fight of that over Good Burger, of all things. Where Siskel was like, he's like, these characters are idiots. And Roger Ebert's like, well, no, they aren't, because they take out the bad guy at the end. They solve the mystery. And he's like, yeah, but they're idiots. And Ebert's like, but in the context of the film, they aren't, because they solve the thing. And that's always stuck with me, because it's like, well, it's Ebert realizing inherently, like, you can't look at the film as an outside observer and say, well, these characters are idiots, therefore everything they do has no merit. Within the context of the film, it does. And I appreciate a film that knows what it is, has a purpose that it's trying to achieve, and then sets out to achieve that purpose. The movies that miss the mark are really the ones that had a goal and had no feasible way of getting to that goal. Right. They just were never going to get there, or they tried to get there by means that were just ineffective or didn't work. So, yeah, a huge recommend from Cobweb. Very enjoyable, very solid, great performances from Lizzie Kaplan and Anthony Starr. If this is the kind of stuff that Anthony Starr is going to spin himself out into from the success of The Boys, to find these kind of like interesting smaller projects that he can bring this kind of talent and energy to, then I'm very excited for his post Boys career. Like, I really want to see what that guy does. I hope he doesn't get pulled into the like standard romantic lead guy stuff.
I don't know, like, if I could sell him as that.
I know somebody out there wants to try, because he is a very conventionally attractive dude. Yeah. Like, he's very handsome.
But I hope he knows the work he's doing on The Boys now is laying a foundation for people finding him attractive later.
He's going to be creepy as fuck. But anyway, so yes, just a huge recommend. I really, really enjoyed this and can't recommend highly enough.
Yeah. Same for me.
So, all right. Well, if anybody wants to find you online to express their opinions about small bottle horror films, where can they do that?
Oh, you can find me curating my Homelander gift collection on Twitter still, at Baskinator. I'm also on Blue Sky, and I'm on Tumblr, and I'm on all the social things.
You're everywhere, yeah.
You can find me
at all the things. I'm starting my Woody Norman fan page over on Twitter/X.
He's got a bright future.
He's got a bright future in Hollywood ahead of him. That last voyage of the Demeter sold it to me.
I don't think that sold anything to anybody.
It really didn't. Which I feel bad because it was directed by Audrey Overdahl, the Autopsy of Jane Doe guy. And oh man, he's got so much skill. Stop making bad project choices. Anyway, you can find me over on X, the giant sinking Hindenburg style hard airship that Elon Musk is running over there. I'm still there at T-Baskin. You can get us at failurepiece@gmail.com and FPiece Theater on X/Twitter if you want to do that as well. I do have a Blue Sky account. Not sure what I'm going to do with it yet. I'm kind of curating it a little bit. Not sure where that's going to go, but maybe. And then maybe you can just search my name. You'll find my blog and we'll just blog. We'll all blog again. That was fun.
I would love to start blogging.
Let's go back to personal blogs, man.
Let's all join IRC channels and blog.
And
blog
at live dungeons. Again. Yeah, like just live journal should come back. That's where the real.
You know, I got to tell you something. Live journal never left.
Just, it's true.
Everybody quit using it and then they sold it.
As far as I know, George R.R. Martin's still over there maintaining that live journal page. just thriving over there on Live Journal, making his NFL weekly picks and not writing Game of Thrones books, just having a great old time. But all right, well, that'll wrap us up for the week. We will be back in the very near future with more discussions of those potential failure pieces, those misses that Hollywood put out there and just couldn't get it across the line. But maybe it's still worth your time. Who knows? But we'll find out together.
Bye-bye.